welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Autumn is eternally the high literary season of the year, and happily for us, the publishers do not disappoint with their new crop of titles. This week, we'll preview new nonfiction making all the bestseller lists and making the rounds as conversation starters at the get-togethers of your reading friends. The books are from writers of exceptional range and achievement, from Elizabeth Gilbert's exploration of creativity to Ta-Nehisi Coates' discussion of America's racial history. My guest today, Jane McGonigal, joins us to speak about making the leap from gaming to being gameful. If you loved her innovative TED Talk, you'll love her new book. So, ready to get started? I'm game. Let's turn now to page one of the book report. In Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, Elizabeth Gilbert, she of Eat, Pray, Love fame, shares her wisdom and unique understanding of creativity. She shatters the perceptions of mystery that surround the process and show us how easy it can be to be creative. By sharing stories from her own life, as well as from people who've inspired her, Elizabeth challenges us to embrace our curiosity, tackle what we love most, and face down what we most fear. Whether you long to write a book, create art, cope with challenges at work, embark on a long-held dream, or make your everyday life more rewarding, Big Magic, performed by the author, will take you on a joyful journey of exploration.
Around campus, they started jokingly calling the position the Gilbert Chair. I found Jack Gilbert's books in my office, the office that had once been his. It was almost like the room was still warm from his presence. I read his poems and was overcome by their grandeur and by how much his writing reminded me of Whitman. "We must risk delight," he wrote. "We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world." He and I had the same surname. We'd held the same job. We had inhabited the same office. We had taught many of the same students. And now I was in love with his words. Naturally enough, I became deeply curious about him. I asked around, who was Jack Gilbert? Students told me he was the most extraordinary man they'd ever encountered. He had seemed not quite of this world, they said. He seemed to live in a state of uninterrupted marvel, and he encouraged them to do the same. He didn't so much teach them how to write poetry, they said, but why? Because of delight, because of stubborn gladness. He told them that they must live their most creative lives as a means of fighting back against the ruthless furnace of this world. Most of all, though, he asked his students to be brave. Without bravery, he instructed, they would never be able to realize the vaulting scope of their own capacities. Without bravery, they would never know the world as richly as it longs to be known. Without bravery, their lives would remain small, far smaller than they probably wanted their lives to be. I never met Jack Gilbert myself, and now he is gone. He passed away in 2012. I probably could have made it a personal mission to seek him out and meet him while he was still living, but I never really wanted to. Experience has taught me to be careful of meeting my heroes in person. It can be terribly disappointing. Anyway, I quite liked the way he lived inside my imagination as a massive and powerful presence, built out of his poems and the stories I'd heard about him. So I decided to know him only that way, through my imagination. And that's where he remains for me to this day, still alive inside me, completely internalized, almost as though I dreamed him up. But I will never forget what the real Jack Gilbert told somebody else. An actual flesh and blood person, a shy University of Tennessee student. This young woman recounted to me that one afternoon, after his poetry class, Jack had taken her aside. He complimented her work, then asked her what she wanted to do with her life. Hesitantly, she admitted that perhaps she wanted to be a writer. He smiled at the girl with infinite compassion and asked, "Do you have the courage? Do you have the courage to bring forth this work? The treasures that are hidden inside you are hoping you will say yes." Creative Living Defined. So this, I believe, is the central question upon which all creative living hinges. Do you have the courage to bring forth the treasures that are hidden within you? Look, I don't know what's hidden within you. I have no way of knowing such a thing. You yourself may barely know, although I suspect you've caught glimpses. I don't know your capacities, your aspirations, your longings, your secret talents, but surely something wonderful is sheltered inside you. I say this with all confidence because I happen to believe that we are all walking repositories of buried treasure. I believe this is one of the oldest and most generous tricks the universe plays on us human beings, both for its own amusement and for ours. The universe buries strange jewels deep within us all, and then stands back to see if we can ever find them. The hunt to uncover those jewels, that's creative living. The courage to go on that hunt in the first place, that's what separates a mundane existence from a more enchanted one. The often surprising results of that hunt, that's what I call big magic.
We've just heard Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert. Jean McGonigal is the best-selling author of 2011's Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better, and How They Can Change the World. She's created and deployed award-winning games, sports, and secret missions in more than 30 countries for partners that include the International Olympics Committee, the American Heart Association, the World Bank Institute, and the New York Public Library. Jane's games challenge players to tackle real-world problems, poverty, hunger, and climate change through planetary-scale collaboration. Her best-known work includes Evoke, Superstruct, World Without Oil, Cruel to Be Kind, Find the Future, and The Lost Ring. Her games have been featured in the New York Times, Wired, The Economist, and on MTV, CNN, and NPR. Jane is also a future forecaster. She's the director of games research and development at the Institute for the Future, a nonprofit research group in Palo Alto, California. Her future forecasting work has been featured in Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, Oprah Magazine, The New York Times Science Section, and many more. Jane holds a PhD from the University of California in performance studies and has consulted and developed internal game workshops for more than a dozen Fortune 500 companies. She's taught game design and game theory at UC Berkeley and the San Francisco Art Institute. She enjoys speaking to global audiences. Perhaps you've seen her extremely popular TED Talk. A former New Yorker, she now lives in San Francisco with her husband. Today, Jane stops by the program to speak about her newest title, Super Better, which outlines her process, a game, that has helped nearly 500,000 players tackle real-life health challenges, such as depression, anxiety, chronic pain, and traumatic brain injury. Welcome, Jane, and thanks for stopping by the Book Report.
My pleasure.
I don't think of myself as a gamer, though I do play Words with Friends. But I have a 20-something-year-old son who, in my opinion, spends way too much time on video games. So is your book for me, and why?
Sure. Well, absolutely, because we know now from years of research that the best way that people can actually benefit from the games that they play is by having conversations with their loved ones about how the games are making them stronger. So, you know, your son, for example, may feel like the game helps him be more resilient in the face of setbacks. He might feel that it's improving his communication and coordination skills with teammates. Maybe he just feels it makes him more creative. Having conversations about what skills and abilities that our favorite games build up make us more likely to use those same skills and abilities to solve problems in our everyday lives. So you absolutely, you could read this book, you could start those conversations and help your son not, you know, be addicted to video games, but really to use them as a source of strength to improve his real life.
What do you say to a parent who worries that when a kid is spending so many hours on a video game that he's isolated from, you know, the bigger society?
I mean, lots of things you should keep in mind. First of all, kids should not really be playing games in isolation all the time. Unfortunately, we know that 3 out of 4 gaming hours with kids today are spent playing games with people they have relationships with in everyday life, with their siblings, with their friends, with their parents, with their classmates. And that's really important because a lot of the benefits that we associate with playing games come from the way that they improve and strengthen our real relationships. You know, we know that young kids who play games with their parents are more likely to come to their parents with a real-life problem, to talk to them honestly about their problems and to ask for real help, because playing games sort of creates a model for parents as your ally, you know, not just an authority figure, but somebody who works with you to overcome challenges. So you should basically, if you're a parent, you have to play with your kids. You have to get involved. They shouldn't be alone playing by themselves. It's a really profound opportunity to strengthen your bond and to play with them. And even if they're playing games you don't want to play, you talk to them about it. You ask them questions. You know, what does this game make you good at? What does it take to succeed in this game? And then they start to think, oh, you know, I do have these skills and abilities that the game is improving. And that's the pathway to using those skills in real life.
Okay. Why the title of your new book, Super Better?
Yeah, well, you know, Super Better, the book, is really looking at how we can use games not just to solve problems more effectively in our real lives, but also if we're facing extreme challenges, you know, an illness, an injury, a trauma, or grief, how can we use the same mindset that we approach to be so resilient and so determined in games, to stay engaged with our toughest challenges, to not escape, you know, to not be overwhelmed by anxiety and stress. And there is a scientific term for the kind of mindset that really seems to produce as positive results. It's called post-traumatic growth, which is related to post-traumatic stress disorder, but it's the kinds of positive outcomes that you can have after dealing with a really extreme challenge. And post-traumatic growth is kind of a wonky term. So I use the term super better instead. It means that you're not just, you know, getting back to normal. You're becoming better than you were before, stronger than you were. You know, how you have more courage to lead your life according to what really matters to you and not what others expect of you. And so that's what super better means, to having that post-traumatic growth in the face of really tough challenges.
You know, I was so fascinated. You wrote about Snow World and its effects on burn victims. Can you talk about that game?
Sure. Yeah, you know, in the first part of the book, I focus on actual video games, not just ways of thinking that are like video games, but real games that you can play to have a positive impact on health and happiness. And Snow World is one of the games that's been extensively studied. It's a 3D virtual reality game where you're wandering through this like wonderful snow fantasy land, and you throw snowballs at penguins, and there's ice caves to explore. But it was actually developed for burn patients to be played during the process of their wounds being cleaned, which is widely known to be the single most painful medical procedure, even with extreme doses of morphine and other really powerful painkillers. The patients will report being in extreme pain 91% of the time, the worst pain you can possibly feel. When these same patients play the video game during the treatments, they actually experience significantly less pain. They report that the game reduces pain more than the drugs that they're receiving, more than morphine, and many of them have no conscious awareness of the pain for up to 90% of the time. And it turns out, you know, you can put gamers playing this game in fMRI machines and see the blood flow activity in their brain to try to figure out how is this possible. And it turns out that they're not being distracted from the pain. Their brain literally is not processing the pain because it's so absorbed in the game. All the blood in the brain is flowing to the problem-solving regions of the brain, the visual processing regions of the brain. There's no blood left over to process the pain signals being sent from the nerves. So it's not distraction. You're actually deciding, where do I want to spend my cognitive resources? And if you can be in control of that, you can stop the brain from having any conscious awareness, you know, of these pain signals. It's kind of profound.
We're speaking with Jane McGonigal on the Book Report. How does one make the leap from games to gameful?
know, it really is that process of identifying what games make you better at and learning to think about that as a part of who you are, as a part of your core identity.
Why is adopting a secret identity actually a good thing?
Right. So, I mean, this goes back to the Superbetter method, you know, which is where we're trying to use the same ways of thinking in games in our everyday lives. And a secret identity is a way of having a kind of heroic persona that you feel you embody when you're facing a really tough challenge. Adopting this heroic persona has been found to help people more effectively focus on the things that they control that are true strengths. And it could be your creativity, it could be your ability to love and be loved by others. You know, whatever is core to you and your strengths, you craft an identity that helps you feel like you embody those strengths, and then you're more likely to bring them to your challenge.
Could you just briefly introduce us to the rules of the Superbetter method?
Yeah, I mean, there are seven rules. The first is to challenge yourself, and we ask you to identify a challenge that you want to embrace. But we have you frame it with that same kind of positive, what can I get better at goal that you would have in a video game. There are six other rules, you know, how do you collect power-ups, things that make you feel stronger in everyday life? How do you identify the bad guys and stay engaged with them instead of running away from them or trying to suppress or avoid them? How do you creatively tackle the things that cause you stress or pain or frustration? We have you do quests every day, which are little things that you can do in the next 24 hours to be true to your core values, the things that matter most to you, which it can be hard to do if you're suffering, if you're injured, or you're depressed. We have you recruit allies who will know what your power-ups are so they can bring them to you. They know who your bad guys are so they can help you battle them. We have you adopt a secret identity, and then you go for epic wins. And the epic win is a kind of really positive outcome that you could not have predicted before you started.
You know, when I picked up your book, I was not a believer, but after I read it, I was so impressed and really energized, and I'm giving it to my son now for him to read. It's really mind-blowing in a way.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, that is my goal, to blow minds.
Well, Jane, I can see it too. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
Bye now.
Bye.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of Superbetter, performed by the author.
These three qualities are all it takes to become happier, braver, and more resilient in the face of any challenge. Here's the good news. You already have these qualities within you. You don't have to change a thing. You are already more powerful than you realize. You have the ability to control your attention and therefore your thoughts and feelings. You have the strength to find support in the most unexpected places and deepen your existing relationships. You have a natural capacity to motivate yourself and supercharge your heroic qualities like willpower, compassion, and determination. This audiobook will help you understand the powers you already have and show you that accessing these powers is as easy as playing a game. And yet, this audiobook is not about playing games, at least not exactly. It's about learning how to be gameful in the face of extreme stress and personal challenge. Being gameful means bringing the psychological strengths you naturally display when you play games, such as optimism, creativity, courage, and determination, to your real life. It means having the curiosity and openness to play with different strategies to discover what works best. It means building up the resilience to tackle tougher and tougher challenges with greater and greater success. The best way I know to explain what it means to be gameful and how being gameful can make you stronger, happier, and braver is to tell you a story. It's the story of how I invented the Superbetter method and the life-threatening challenge I had to overcome to be able to write this book. In the summer of 2009, I hit my head and got a concussion. It didn't heal properly, and after 30 days, I still had constant headaches, nausea, and vertigo. I couldn't read or write for more than a few minutes at a time. I had trouble remembering things. Most days, I felt too sick to get out of bed. I was in a total mental fog. These symptoms left me more anxious and depressed than I had ever been in my life. I had trouble communicating clearly to friends and family exactly what I was going through. I thought if I could write something down, it would help. I struggled and struggled to put together words that made sense, and this is what I came up with. Everything is hard. The iron fist is pushing against my thoughts. My whole brain feels vacuum pressurized. If I can't think, who am I? Unfortunately, there is no real treatment for post-concussion syndrome. You just rest as much as you can and hope for the best. I was told I might not feel better for months or even a year or longer. There was one thing I could try to do to heal faster. My doctor told me I should avoid everything that triggered my symptoms. That meant no reading, no writing, no running, no video games, no work, no email, no alcohol, and no caffeine. I joked to my doctor at the time. In other words, no reason to live. There was quite a bit of truth in that joke. I didn't know it then, but suicidal ideation is very common with traumatic brain injuries, even mild ones like mine. It happens to 1 in 3, and it happened to me. My brain started telling me, "Jane, you want to die." It said, "You're never going to get better. The pain will never end. You'll be a burden to your husband." These voices became so persistent and so persuasive that I started to legitimately fear for my life. And then something happened. I had one crystal clear thought that changed everything. 34 days after I hit my head, and I will never forget this moment, I said to myself, "I am either going to kill myself, or I'm going to turn this into a game." Why a game? By the time I hit my head in 2009, I'd been researching the psychology of games for nearly a decade. In fact, I was the first person in the world to earn a PhD studying the psychological strengths of gamers and how those strengths can translate to real-world problem solving. I knew from my years of research at the University of California, Berkeley, that when we play a game, we tackle tough challenges with more creativity, more determination, and more optimism. We're also more likely to reach out to others for help. And I wanted to bring these gameful traits to my real-life challenge.
That was Super Better by Jane McGonigal. The physics of vulnerability is simple. If we are brave enough, often enough, we will fall. But popular author and TED Talk presenter Brené Brown's Rising Strong explains what it takes to get back up. The way in which we own our stories of disappointment, failure, and heartbreak gives us the power to write a daring new ending. Brené performs the book.
During an interview in 2013, a reporter told me that after reading The Gifts of Imperfection and Daring Greatly, he wanted to start working on his own issues related to vulnerability, courage, and authenticity. He laughed and said, "It sounds like it could be a long road. Can you give me the upside of doing this work?" I told him that with every ounce of my professional and personal being, I believe that vulnerability, the willingness to show up and be seen with no guarantee of outcome, is the only path to more love, belonging, and joy. He quickly followed up with, "And the downside?" This time I was the one laughing. You're going to stumble, fall, and get your ass kicked. There was a long pause before he said, "Is this where you tell me that you think daring is still worth it?" I responded with a passionate yes, followed by a confession. Today, it's a solid yes, because I'm not lying face down after a hard fall. But even in the midst of struggle, I would still say that doing this work is not only worth it, it is the work of living a wholehearted life. But I promise that if you asked me about this in the midst of a fall, I'd be far less enthusiastic and way more off. I'm not great at falling and feeling my way back. It's been 2 years since that interview. 2 years of practicing being brave and putting myself out there. And vulnerability is still uncomfortable, and falling still hurts. It always will. But I'm learning that the process of struggling and navigating hurt has as much to offer us as the process of being brave and showing up. Over the past couple of years, I've had the privilege of spending time with some amazing people. They range from top entrepreneurs and leaders in Fortune 500 companies to couples who have maintained loving relationships for more than 30 years and parents working to change the education system. As they've shared their experiences and stories of being brave, falling, and getting back up, I kept asking myself this question. What do these people with strong relationships, parents with deep connections to their children, teachers nurturing creativity and learning, clergy walking with people through faith, and trusted leaders have in common? The answer was clear. They recognize the power of emotion, and they're not afraid to lean into discomfort. While vulnerability is the birthplace of many of the fulfilling experiences we long for, love, belonging, joy, creativity, and trust, just to name a few, the process of regaining our emotional footing in the midst of struggle is where our courage is tested and our values are forged. Rising strong after a fall is how we cultivate wholeheartedness in our lives. It's the process that teaches us the most about who we are. In the past 2 years, my team and I have also received emails every week from people who write, "I dared greatly. I was brave. I got my butt kicked, and now I'm down for the count. How do I get back up?" I knew when I was writing The Gifts and Daring Greatly that I would ultimately write a book about falling down. I've collected that data all along, and what I've learned about surviving hurt has saved me again and again. It saved me, and in the process, it changed me. Here's how I see the progression of my work. The Gifts of Imperfection, be you. Daring Greatly, be all in. Rising Strong, fall, get up, try again. The thread that runs through all three of these books is our yearning to live a wholehearted life. I define wholehearted living as engaging in our lives from a place of worthiness. It means cultivating the courage, compassion, and connection to wake up in the morning and think, "You know what? No matter what gets done and how much is left undone, I'm enough."
That was Rising Strong by Brené Brown. Sisters-in-Law is the fascinating story of Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg's intertwined lives. Republican and Democrat, Christian and Jew, Western rancher's daughter and Brooklyn girl, O'Connor and Ginsburg were strengthened by each other's presence. These groundbreaking judges, the first and second women to serve on the highest court in the land, worked tirelessly to make America a more equal place for women. Linda Hirschman's dual biography includes revealing stories of how each fought for recognition in a male-dominated profession. She spotlights the way these two justices shaped the legal framework of modern feminism, tackling employment discrimination, abortion, affirmative action, and sexual harassment. The book combines legal detail with warm personal anecdotes that bring these very different women sharply into focus. Meticulously researched and compellingly performed by Andrea Gallo, you'll find this both an authoritative account of our changing culture and a moving story of a remarkable friendship.
Why, the introduction to the special issue asked, were American women, while enjoying more material, political, and social advantages than any other women in history, nonetheless so discontent with their lot? And the editors got an earful. The writer Catherine Drinker Bowen speculated that the revolution was imminent in light of the falling birth rate, since surely no woman can devote a life to the raising of only two kids. Paula Stern, fresh out of graduate school at Harvard, described marriage as a refuge from a hostile world and an agency in making sure it stayed bad in the future. Once married, she can stop fighting cultural stereotypes and start teaching them to her children. Sociologist and women's rights activist Alice Rossi told the magazine the insulting stories she'd been gathering from working women, stories that must have been resonant and reassuring to the Stanford law grad who was offered only a secretarial berth when she applied. "I never wanted to teach grade school children," one woman had told Rossi, "but I found so much prejudice and resentment against me in my first job in an architectural firm that I couldn't take it. I left and switched to teaching art. At least I feel welcome in a school." Another reported that she had the experience last year of seeing a job I had filled for 2 years upgraded when it was filled by a man at double the salary I was paid for the same work. College-trained women are lumped with the secretarial and clerical staff, while college-trained men are seen as potential executives. A few years of this, and everybody is behaving according to what is expected of them, not what they are capable of. Rossi's article included this now commonplace but then revolutionary insight. If women are vital and assertive, they're rejected as aggressive bitches out to castrate men. If they're quiet and unassuming, they're rejected as unlikely to amount to much. O'Connor struggled visibly to thread that same needle. She ran for office, but she ran home to make dinner every night for her husband and 3 sons. In an early speech to women students at the local university, she extolled the virtues of dependence on a male spouse. "Those women who are fortunate enough to have husbands or other means to support them can truly enjoy the freedom of choice to select that work which is most satisfying to them, and to select work of a part-time or occasional nature." She repeated without irony John O'Connor's joke about her career in speeches about how to combine love and work. "I think it is a tribute to American democracy," O'Connor's lawyer husband said, "when a cook, who moonlights as a janitor, can be elected to high public office." When O'Connor wrote to President Nixon in 1971 on the subject of the 2 Supreme Court nominations he had before him, it was merely to encourage him to consider for appointment one of the well-qualified women lawyers in our country today. But she hastened to reassure him that she was confident that his selections will be well-considered and wise. After all, Chief Justice Warren Burger has already proven himself to the American people to have been a splendid choice. Unknown to O'Connor, Burger had made his opposition to a female nomination clear to the president, threatening to resign if the president polluted the court with a woman. O'Connor may have read the Atlantic articles on what women want, but she turned down the page corner at the piece that cataloged the laws at every level of American government that treated women differently. The Equal Rights Amendment-fueled attack on the web of legal discrimination against women suited her perfectly. Exactly like Ginsburg at her feminist awakening, O'Connor began creating a hit list of such laws in her case in the state she was helping to govern and set about having them changed.
That was a sampling of Sisters-in-Law by Linda Hirschman. More about our courts. Will Haywood's new title, Showdown, has been described as history with thunder. Haywood surpasses the emotional impact of his bestseller, The Butler, to detail the life and career of one of the most transformative legal minds of the past 100 years. Thurgood Marshall brought down the separate but equal doctrine, integrated schools, and not only fought for human rights and human dignity, but also made them impossible to deny in the courts. Using the framework of the contentious five-day Senate hearing to confirm Marshall as the first African-American Supreme Court justice, Haygood creates a provocative look at Marshall's life, as well as the politicians, lawyers, activists, and others who shaped or tried to stop the civil rights movement. Major players included Lyndon Johnson, Adam Clayton Powell, John Robert and Ted Kennedy, Strom Thurmond, and Sam Ervin. Dominic Hoffman narrates this fascinating biography of the man, his turbulent times, and our nation's racial politics.
Marshall was its architect. He utilized the services of plenty of other lawyers, but he quickly became its marquee performer. He roamed the country. When he wasn't in the courtroom, he packed lecture halls and churches and amassed a stunning array of landmark court victories. There was Smith v. Allwright in 1944, a case that outlawed the all-white Democratic primary in Texas. Shelley v. Kramer made front-page news in 1948, in which the High Court ruled it was illegal to bar Negroes and other minorities from purchasing property, even if the homeowner had written it into a clause of the deed. 2 years later, in another case rooted in Texas, came the Sweat v. Painter victory, in which the High Court ordered the University of Texas to admit a Negro it had previously barred from its law school. It was while in Texas during the primary court battle that Thurgood Marshall first began hearing of a young U.S. Senate candidate by the name of Lyndon Johnson. Johnson did not win his 1941 Senate campaign, but Marshall was very much aware that as labor forces abandoned Johnson's candidacy, the Negro support stuck with him. Then, in 1954, came the Marshall-led titanic achievement of Brown v. Board of Education, which outlawed the separate but equal doctrine that had been the law of the land and ordered the desegregation of public schools. That decision tore at the spiritual heart of all who believed that separate was equal in any facet of American society. There was not another lawyer in America whose constitutional victories could match Thurgood Marshall's in the arena of equal rights. It was as if Marshall had rethreaded parts of the Constitution itself, stitching the Negro, at long last, into the fabric of the nation. The NAACP legal victories were both wonderful and newsworthy, but because they were rarely respected by federal willpower or muscle, they were often ignored and went unenforced. Municipalities worked tirelessly to devise tricky and malevolent ways to get around the high court decisions. The Negro was still not free. Then came the early 1960s newsreel footage of Negroes being beaten and bitten by dogs held by law enforcement officers, all because of the quest for freedom. Following President Kennedy's assassination, Lyndon Johnson assumed the presidency. American presidents were bewitched by race. Johnson, however, understood that when three civil rights workers, Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner, and James Cheney, went missing and were found murdered in Mississippi in 1964, a new era had begun. On March 7, 1965, 9 months after the Mississippi murders, civil rights activists gathered in an attempt to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, in a quest for voting rights. A nation saw scores of marchers being viciously beaten. Northern cities were soon torched in widespread rioting. Johnson knew the time had come that Negroes would not retreat. He had signed the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964. Finally, the 1965 Voting Rights Act was signed into law. Now he had signed two of the most powerful pieces of presidential legislation since the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation. It mattered not at all to him that the South vowed to rebel in the midst of all the civil rights legislation and melodrama taking place. And it mattered not at all that Southern senators were castigating him in their home districts. Some refused his invitations to the White House for coffee. But Lyndon Johnson was not yet finished. The U.S. Supreme Court, since its founding, had always featured white justices. A Negro had never even been seriously considered. Even as Johnson was fighting a war in Vietnam and battling poverty, it was race that truly haunted and tore at the fabric and fragility of a nation. The nastiest mail we got was over race. not Vietnam, says the LBJ aide Joseph Califano. On the morning of June 13, 1967, LBJ gathered some key members of his staff in the Oval Office. Among them were the aides Marvin Watson and Clifford Alexander. Also, there was Thurgood Marshall, who had been a federal appeals court judge and was the current Solicitor General, and Lewis Martin, a White House political advisor.
That was Showdown by Will Haygood. By Toni Morrison as required reading, Between the World and Me is Ta-Nehisi Coates' bold and personal literary exploration of America's racial history. The New York Observer has called Coates the single best writer on the subject of race in the United States. In a profound work that pivots from the biggest questions about American history and ideals to the most intimate concerns of a father for his son, Coates offers a powerful new framework for understanding our nation's history and current crises. What is it like to inhabit a black body and find a way to live within it? And how can we all honestly reckon with the fraught history of African Americans and be free from its burden? Between the World and Me is Coates' attempt to answer these questions in a letter to his adolescent son. Coates shares the story of his awakening to the truth about his place in the world through a series of revelatory experiences, from Howard University to Civil War battlefields, from the South Side of Chicago to Paris. The book, performed by the author, clearly illuminates the past, bracingly confronts our present, and offers a transcendent vision for a way forward.
In the years after Prince Jones died, I thought often of those who were left to make their lives in the shadow of his death. I thought of his fiancée and wondered what it meant to see the future upended with no explanation. I wondered what she would tell his daughter, and I wondered how his daughter would imagine her father when she would miss him, how she would detail the loss. But mostly I wondered about Prince's mother, and the question I mostly asked myself was always the same. How did she live? I searched for her phone number online. I emailed her. She responded. Then I called and made an appointment to visit. And living she was, just outside of Philadelphia, in a small gated community of affluent homes. It was a rainy Tuesday when I arrived. I had taken the train in from New York and then picked up a rental car. I was thinking of Prince a lot in those months before. You, your mother, and I had gone to homecoming at the Mecca, and so many of my friends were there, and Prince was not. Dr. Jones greeted me at the door. She was lovely, polite, brown. She appeared to be somewhere in that range between 40 and 70 years, when it becomes difficult to precisely ascertain a black person's precise age. She was well composed given the subject of our conversation, and for most of the visit, I struggled to separate how she actually felt from what I felt she must be feeling. What I felt right then was that she was smiling through pained eyes, that the reason for my visit had spread sadness like a dark quilt over the whole house. I seemed to recall music, jazz or gospel, playing in the back, but conflicting with that, I also remember a deep quiet overcoming everything. I thought that perhaps she had been crying. I could not tell for sure. She led me into her large living room. There was no one else in the house. It was early January. Her Christmas tree was still standing at the end of the room, and there were stockings bearing the name of her daughter and her lost son, and there was a framed picture of him, Prince Jones, on a display table. She brought me water in a heavy glass. She drank tea. She told me that she was born and raised outside of Opelousas, Louisiana, that her ancestors had been enslaved in that same region, and that as a consequence of that enslavement, a fear echoed down through the ages. It first became clear when I was 4, she told me. My mother and I were going into the city. We got on the Greyhound bus. I was behind my mother. She wasn't holding my hand at the time, and I plopped down in the first seat I found. A few minutes later, my mother was looking for me, and she took me to the back of the bus and explained why I couldn't sit there. We were very poor, and most of the black people around us who I knew were poor also, and the images I had of white America were from going into the city and seeing who was behind the counter in the stores and seeing who my mother worked for. It became clear there was a distance. This chasm makes itself known to all of us in all kinds of ways. a little girl wanders home at age 7 after being teased in school and asks her parents, "Are we niggas, and what does that mean?" Sometimes it is subtle, the simple observation of who lives where and works what job and who does not. Sometimes it's all of it at once. I have never asked how you became personally aware of the distance. Was it Mike Brown? I don't think I want to know. But I know that it has happened to you already, that you have deduced that you are privileged and yet still different from other privileged children because you are the bearer of a body more fragile than any other in this country. What I want you to know is that this is not your fault, even if it is ultimately your responsibility. It is your responsibility because you are surrounded by the dreamers. It has nothing to do with how you wear your pants or how you style your hair. The breach is as intentional as policy, as intentional as the forgetting that follows. The breach allows for the efficient sorting of the plundered from the plunderers, the enslaved from the enslavers, sharecroppers from landholders, cannibals from food.
We've just heard Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. For the past 50 years, one of my favorite travel authors, Paul Theroux, has traveled to the four corners of the compass. In Deep South, he turns his gaze to a region much closer to home. Traveling through North and South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, and Arkansas, he writes of the stunning landscapes he discovers, the deserts, the mountains, the Mississippi, and above all, the lives of the people he meets. John McDonough performs the book.
Poverty is well-dressed in churches, and everyone is approachable. As a powerful and revealing cultural event, a Southern church service is on a par with a college football game or a gun show, and there are many of them. People say there's a church on every corner. That is also why, when a church is bombed, and this was the 50th anniversary of the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, where four little girls were murdered, the heart is torn out of a congregation, and a community plunges into pure anguish. "You lost?" Her voice had been so soft, I had not realized she'd been talking to me. It was the woman in the car beside me, a sun-faded sedan with a crushed and cracked rear bumper. She was sipping coffee from a carry-out paper cup. Her car door swung open for the breeze. She was in her late 40s, perhaps, with blue-gray eyes, and in contrast to the poor car, she was dressed beautifully in black silk with lacy sleeves, a big flower pinned to her shoulder, wearing a white hat with a veil that she lifted with the back of her hand when she raised the coffee cup to her pretty lips, leaving a puckered kiss daub of purple lipstick on the rim. I said I was a stranger here. "Ain't no strangers here, baby," she said, and gave me a merry smile. The South, I was to find, was one of the few places I'd been in the world where I could use the word merry without sarcasm. "I'm Lucille." I told her my name and where I wanted to go, the Cornerstone Full Gospel Baptist Church on Brooksdale Drive. She was quick to say that it was not her church, but that she knew the one. She said the name of the pastor, Bishop Ernest Palmer, began to give me directions, and then said, "Tell you what." One hand tipping her veil, she stared intently at the rim of her cup. She paused and drank the last of her coffee while I waited for another word. "Shoot, it's easier for me to take you there," she said, then used the tip of her tongue to work a fleck of foam from her upper lip. "I don't have to meet my daughter for another hour. Just follow me, Mr. Paul." I dogged the crushed rear bumper of her small car for about 3 miles, making unexpected turns into and out of subdivisions of small bungalows that had been so hollowed out by a devastating tornado the previous year, they could accurately be described as fistulated and tortured. In the midst of this scoured landscape, on a suburban street, I saw the church steeple, and Lucille slowed down and pointed and waved me on. As I passed her to enter the parking lot, I thanked her, and she gave me a wonderful smile, and just before she drove on, she said, "Be blessed." That seemed to be the theme in the Deep South. Kindness, generosity, a welcome. I had found it often in my traveling life, in the wider world, but I found so much more of it here that I kept going, because the goodwill was like an embrace. Yes, there is a haunted substratum of darkness in Southern life, and though it pulses through many interactions, it takes a long while to perceive it, and even longer to understand.
We've just heard Deep South by Paul Theroux. Readers, new ideas, riveting biographies, thinking that takes a bold leap forward. I found today's nonfiction selections incredibly compelling. I hope you agree. Find the titles that everyone is talking about on my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.